Warning, the following podcast will contain spoilers for all published works of George R.R. Martin. And probably some other stuff, too. I don't know.
Didn't you watch any of the trailers?
No! Because I don't like trailers, because they spoil a movie.
Back to Vassals of Kingsgrave for our 37th episode in linear reread of A Song of Ice and Fire. My name is Adam, also known as Drowned Snow on the podcast of Ice and Fire Forms. I'll be your host for the evening. And I am joined by...
Hey, this is Varley on the forums.
Hi, this is Alex. I Wendy on the forums.
Hello. Pops on the forums, now in real life.
Hi, this is Lady Weaver on the forums, Sarah in real life.
Hi, everyone.
What's up, Mundo Jock 2 on the forums.
All right, and we might be joined by a not-so-surprised guest later on, who I'm not going to even bother introducing. So we're going to be covering, let's see, this is October 15th of 299 through October 30th of 299. It's going to be Jon 1, Arya 2, Arya 3, and Sansa 1 of A Storm of Swords. So still very early chapters. All right.
Yeah, shit hasn't turned completely sideways yet.
There's still hope in the air, right? You know?
Right.
The Battle of the Blackwater didn't go quite as we'd all wanted, but, you know, things can still go okay. Most of the characters are still alive. No one's had anything too terribly happen, except for, you know, the entire Stark family.
Well, I mean, the prologue didn't work out well for the Night's Watch, but...
Right. But we won't come back to that for several...
Right, until we get...
None of that will matter.
Right.
Okay. So, let's see. The first chapter we have is Jon 1, which is our introduction to Mance Rayder and Jon arriving at the Wildling camp. And I believe we have... Nadia, summary for that?
Yes. Okay, so Jon 1. In Rattleshirt's company, guarded by Grit and Longspear Rick, Jon approaches the Wildling camp. Rattleshirt tells Jon that Mance will immediately realize Jon has not truly turned his cloak, and then Rattleshirt will be free to kill him. Ygritte, however, assures Jon that once Mance hears how Jon killed the Halfhand, he'll accept him. They're met by the Weeper when they reach the camp, and the Weeper thinks Mance might keep him because he's probably a wog. Jon keeps reminding himself that he's there for one reason only, to find out what Mance had been searching for in the Frostfangs. Jon notices that many of the people in the camp are preparing for a war, but most of them are simply carrying on with their lives. After Rattleshirt gives instructions to set up camp, he immediately sets off to take Jon to Mance Rayder. The Wildling camp is so big that to Jon it seems that it stretches on forever, but he observes that it's more like a collection of smaller camps with no fortifications, and it would be really easy for a much smaller but disciplined force to defeat them. They reach Mance Rayder's tent, which is the biggest on the field. Ghost is not allowed inside. Inside, Jon sees that there are four men and two women, a young man and a pretty woman who pay him no attention, a pregnant woman and a gray-haired singer, a short but broad man devouring a chicken, and a tall, lean man with no ears. Jon sees that these last two are warriors and assumes that one of them must be Mance Rayder. The earless man asks about Jon, and Rattleshirt tells them that he's the one that killed Aurel and that he's a wog. But Ygritte quickly adds that Jon also killed Corrin Halfhand and that he's turned his cloak. When the earless man asks Jon his name, Jon tells him and addresses him as Your Grace. The short, broad man finds this hilarious and tells Jon the singer is actually Mance Rayder. Mance already knows that Jon is Ned Stark's son and asks him whether he really killed the Halfhand. Jon tells him that he did, and Mance seems almost sad at the news. He introduces the rest of the people in the tent to Jon. The earless man is the Magnar of Thend. The short man is Tormund Giantsbane. The pregnant woman is Dalla, who's carrying Mance's child and is to be treated as a queen, and the other two are Dalla's sister, Val, and Jarl. Mance asks John why someone from Castle Black was with Shadow Tower Rangers, and John has an excuse ready. Mance asks him how he knew where to find the wildling camp, and Tormund cuts in and says it must have been Cresta. Mance kicks everyone out because he wants to question John without interruptions. He gives John food and drink and tells him he's seen John twice before. Once as a child and once at the feast at Winterfell for King Robert, where Mance posed as a lute player. Mance tells John he's now under guest right and that he must tell Mance the real reason he's deserted the watch. John tells him he'll tell him if Mance tells him why he deserted. Mance says he left for a place where a kiss was not a crime and a man could wear any cloak he chose. In return, John asks him whether Mance had seen where John was sitting on the night of the feast. And Mance tells him he remembers, and John says, John basically asks him, did you see where this place the bastard? And Mance says he remembers. And that's reason enough for John to accept. Sorry, for Mance to accept John.
Because he wasn't at the table. Yeah, so this is interesting, right? Like, Mance was a Black Brother for what, like a minute, it sounds like? But he had enough time.
No, for all his life, right?
No. I mean, like,
he was born there, wasn't he? I mean,
yeah, he was raised by the Night's Watch.
But, like, as soon as they were like, take off your cloak or whatever, you know what I mean? But he had enough time to meet, you know, Eddard, but somehow Benjen wouldn't recognize him.
I felt like that was kind of weird that Benjen wouldn't recognize him.
Because, like, I guess we don't really know exactly when Benjen joined the Watch, but it was a significant portion of time ago. It would have been after, Eddard had a couple heirs, maybe, or I don't know.
But how big is the Watch? Would you really know everyone? Like, do you know everyone in your university class, necessarily? I mean,
well, at Castle Black, everyone knows everyone. Recognize. I guess if you're somewhere else.
Yeah, maybe because he knew Corrin, that, like, he was stationed at the Shadow Tower?
Yeah, that's what I wondered.
Yeah, he was.
Huh.
But he also gives us a rendition of The Dornish Man's Wife, and it'll be the first of three songs I think we get in these chapters, so it's all... George was in a musical mood when he wrote these.
Love that song.
So can I just...
You would. Like,
I really like this this chapter, and the show just completely fucked it.
Yeah, I agree. Like, well, Mance's character. Mance
is a character.
Yeah. But Mance in the book is pretty cool. And yeah, I like that. Well, not that I like, but it was funny that John, like, he's been amping himself up to say, like, I have to join the wildlings and learn their ways and become part of them. And the first thing he does is call someone Your Grace.
The only comment I would make is, I feel your pain on how this was done in the TV show, but it's so long since I watched it. I can't remember why I was so angry, only just the residual sort of angst. Because it was years ago now.
Yeah.
There we go.
I mean, the only thing they got right was Tormund tearing into a chicken.
TV Mance is terrible. It's just...
Yeah. And you dropped out from anger, did you?
Oh, yeah. I had to drop my mic. And it unfortunately dropped the call as well. So, what did you guys think reading this the first time? I mean, I assume that we pretty much all read it without seeing the show first. So there's a bit of a... I don't know. It's very different than the show, but I don't know. It was this, what we had, two books of kind of the wildlings as these sort of, you know, shadow characters off page mostly.
No, I was just going to say that this does kind of show them as a bunch of, like, very separate but weird characters.
Yeah, where you're like, oh, they're people too.
Yeah, they all have their own thing.
I tell you what I thought when I first read it, which was, I mean, I kind of got how cool it was for Mance to infiltrate Winterfell. But I also thought it was a bit like a Bond villain explaining his evil, dastardly plan. Like, if you're able to disguise yourself and infiltrate lots of places, why would you tell the bastard son, who you're not yet... I mean, I guess you can kill him if you really don't trust him, but it just felt like a bit cocky and a bit arrogant and a bit... Like, why would you reveal that? That's just really
dumb. Because villains love to monologue.
Yeah, and I also thought it was a pretty weak sort of reason to leave the... I don't know. The whole thing just seemed very shady. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think he trusts him too easily. Based on the evidence he presented, definitely.
With Mance, I think like later on, what we get out of his character development helps it kind of make sense. You know, like why he left and all this stuff. Because he's just kind of a kooky guy, really. You know?
Dude. But he is great because, like, you get like the feeling that the wildlings, like, you know, value like all sorts of crazy, stupid masculinity tests, and he's just sitting there singing away, like, gives zero fucks, and he's like, whatever, like, you know, I've defeated everyone, and that's why they're all, like, following me. Like, I'll sing whatever I want to. I like him.
He's a very eccentric boss.
Yeah, I feel like he kind of lets everyone do whatever they like. I don't know if he'd be a very good boss, like, in today's world. He'd just be like, sure, do whatever. Just... take your vacation days whenever.
Because yeah, no, like, how did he even get the name King, really? Like, I guess it's because the people down south give him that name, but...
I think he would be a good boss because he's more outcome-driven than, like, micromanaging. He's like, do whatever the fuck you want, but, like, this has to happen. If it doesn't, then there will be consequences.
Yeah, I'll kill you, whatever.
If you get all that done? Yeah. Then I have no problem with whatever you do.
Guys, as well, I think the wildlings actually really respect him, because when Rattleshirt walks into the tent with John and Ygritte, they all stay silent until after Mance finishes talking, and then the Lord of the Thens says what he was thinking when they all walked in, so he actually waited for Mance to finish. So you could say that that's really is a sign of respect in that they waited.
Yeah, considering their general attitudes.
Yeah.
I mean, he's definitely earned his place with them, but it is bizarre to have someone like him leading them. And you kind of wish that we had a little more info on how all that went down, I guess. But it does, like Bina said, it does feel like a bit like, you know, a Bond moment, kind of, you know, like, do you expect me to join you, man? It's like, no, Mr. Snow, I expect you to die.
Perfect.
But I'll tell you exactly what I've been doing. Oh. And I do like that he, like, when he got word that King Robert was coming, he was just like, well, get my horse and my spikes, and I'm going to climb the wall. Like, he just did it all by himself, it sounds like, right? Doesn't sound like anyone else went with him.
Yeah. So when did he see John as a baby? Does he say?
When he was still in the watch. He came with... Yeah, they went down to Winterfell. A bunch of watch people.
Ah.
Yeah.
And they dumped a bunch of snow on, like, Fat Tom or someone, and they didn't rat him out.
Yeah, because he's cool. He's a cool dude.
Mance Rayder comes across as the kind of guy who thinks he's cool and goes around saying he's cool, but probably isn't cool.
That is exactly the vibe I get from him.
He sounds like if he were in contemporary life, he'd be an investment banker. He had a price, left the bank, bought a Harley Davidson, and decided to go on a, you know, open some kind of organic farm. And,
yeah. So come on, John. Do you know how long, like, I've had this loot?
Yeah. He's like bragging about how good his Coke is, and it's really shit.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, that's a new attitude for me. I think when I first read the books, I sort of thought he was cooler than he was, and with passing time and age, I find him just to be more of a douchebag.
You imagine he's got like a ponytail and a leather jacket.
Yes, I do.
With scarlet stripes, right?
And an inappropriately young girlfriend.
Oh, of course. And like, but his girlfriend is definitely friends with his daughter at one point. Like, they grew up together or something.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. So if Mance is this guy, why isn't he sleeping with Val? She's supposed to be the hottie.
Well, I mean, maybe Dahlia's hotter. Like, they're sisters, right? He took the hottest sister, and, you know.
Maybe he's all about the personality.
I mean, come on, I'm sure that he's Mance is, you know, if he's into it, he's sleeping with whoever he wants, right?
Yeah. I feel like he's oddly loyal to his woman, but not to anything else.
After all, he left the Night's Watch for her. Maybe we should give him credence for that. That's a pretty romantic gesture.
I thought he met her more recently.
Yeah, I thought it wasn't the same woman. Sorry, that he left the Night's Watch for.
But still, it suggests a romantic nature. So maybe he is a loyal lover. I don't know.
he just loves that wildling strange.
I feel like he just is like, man, I can't take orders, bro. No one can tell me what to do. I can't be tied down.
So he spent his entire life among the Night's Watch and wildlings. Like, how does he know about Dornish songs?
That's what I didn't get.
There's been singers, probably.
Books? Or how does he know about Dornish people at all? Like, I don't know.
Right, they're like Dorn?
I mean, he is somewhat educated, considering, you know, his upbringing. But did he ever travel?
Could it be a bard actually came to the Night's Watch and joined whatever fort he was on? And then that's how he learned them all?
It does seem that, like, bards often, you know, get in trouble sleeping with lords, you know, daughters, wives, or whatever, and get sent to the Night's Watch. So I bet they have plenty of them up there.
Yeah, I totally think so. Bards are kind of like the rock stars of Westeros, right? And I sort of feel they are. They're like glamorous guys who travel the world, who come to court, and they sing
except
the
they have no power.
Songs, and the Sansa-type princesses would totally like fall for them. And I feel that songs are kind of like currency in Westeros. They would circulate wildly. Like, people who've never been to Dorne will have heard the Dornish songs just because the bards travel around. And so the songs would get around, especially the very old ones, surely.
And some of those songs are certainly going to piss off certain lords, right? Well, you piss off the wrong lord with the wrong song, you know, and he might just send you to the watch.
George loves torturing a singer.
He does, doesn't he?
Or torturing with singers.
I can literally think of like four or five examples.
Right, one got made into stew, one got tortured real bad.
The Tyrion one where he had Bronn kill him. Meridian.
Silver.
Old Brown.
Yeah.
But then there's the other side where you have Lem and, playing at River Run. And...
No, not Tom Lem. Thomas
Evans.
Thomas Evans. Yeah, that's what I mean.
Dude, Thomas Evans is awesome, too.
That's just a badass name, right? Like,
he's in the next chapter, isn't he?
Yep.
First appearance.
Yep.
I think he's kind of an asshole, but we'll get to that later.
They all are. All right. Well, do we have anything else to say on this? Like, anything else we want to cover about this chapter? It's a pretty significant chapter early on in this book.
Yeah.
It seems weird. Oh, sorry. Go.
I was going to say that. And Ygritte actually says, in your hearts, you all want to fly free. And then it's dangerous being free, but most come to like the taste of it. And Mance Rayder says, I left the next morning for a place where a kiss was not a crime and a man could wear any cloak he chose. If you think about it, I think a lot of the characters in the story really feel trapped by their way of life or by societal norms and are actually fighting against them. Like, Jaime is fighting against all of his oaths. Cersei is fighting against being a woman. Bran's fighting against being a cripple and can't actually do a lot of things for himself. And, like, so many characters are fighting against that. And then they're giving Jon a choice, and he's probably the only character that doesn't really feel that way.
Interesting.
I suppose my only other comment was, I don't know if he spoke about this when I was on the phone, was that it really lays out the concept of guest right, which is obviously foreshadowing, but the strength of the language that George uses. So when he says, the laws of hospitality are as old, I've miswritten this down, but he says they're as sacred as the heart tree. Like, he's really laying down just how, like, even a wildling, even people north of the wall would respect this. So he's laying down just how horrific the ultimate betrayal is going to be. So I just thought that was really clever how early that comes up in the books. Brilliant planning.
Yeah.
Wasn't Geistreich a big thing in, like, Nordic cultures? Because once Christianity came, they weren't sure if the guest was an angel or not. I heard something weird, like, and that's why it's like any guest you had to treat, like, really well, because it might be God testing you. So, like, if you were to, like, kill the stranger, like, you get God's wrath.
In Nordic cultures, though. Interesting.
Yeah, so which would, like, translate to the wildlings, like, leaving it, you know, not because they think it's angels, but, you know, for whatever other reason, that Geistreich is so important.
Because it's just, you know, being, like, hospitable. Come on.
Yeah, also they have to live through, like, 8-year-long winters, so they kind of like to survive, I think.
Yeah, and like, I think it could have naturally just developed as, like, people really need, you know, people need shelter and comfort at various times, and you know, yeah, you're always going to be needing it, so, like, everyone needs to feel safe, so everyone's just, even your worst enemy is like, if, you know, if he offers you some bread, you're cool for the night, like, don't worry about it.
Yeah.
Mm. I think for me, it emphasizes John's betrayal a little bit more of the wildlings, like, kind of lays it on thick, like, these guys are vouching for you, feeding you, keeping you warm, and you know you're going to betray them.
Well, you know? I don't know. I mean, but is betrayal the right word when the intention is to infiltrate?
It's a term.
Yeah, when you're given a mission, that's like mission accomplished. It was like, the mission was to infiltrate the wildlings.
But I mean, it's definitely a betrayal to them. But,
well, that's what I mean. It makes, as you were talking about, it makes them more human. It makes you, you know, you like a few of the characters, and now you start to think, oh shit, this isn't, you know, I don't want to betray them, kind of thing.
Yeah. Or, imagine if they betrayed them and then Stannis just killed them, like, to the man. Like, that would be a lot more brutal. Are we ready to move on to Arya 2? So we go to, this is October 22nd of 299. It is chapter 13, 6 chapters ahead. And I believe, let's see who has that.
I do.
Alex, okay, all right.
So Arya 2. Arya and Hot Pie are picking vegetables from an abandoned garden by the Trident when they hear someone coming their way singing. Arya asks Hot Pie to wake up Gendry and hide their horses behind the ruins of a burned-down cottage, while she finds a tree to hide behind, thinking the singer might be alone and easily dealt with. But when one of the horses whinnies, betraying their presence, Arya hears two more voices debating whether or not to shoot arrows over the wall, and one of them says that an honest man would show his face, only an outlaw would skulk and hide. And the archer gets ready to shoot, but Arya jumps out to stop them, sword in hand. She tries to threaten them, but isn't taken seriously. Gendry and Hot Pie soon reveal themselves as well, but the effect isn't as intimidating as they'd hoped. Hot Pie immediately gives the strangers his name, then the singer introduces himself as Thomas Sevenstreams, and his companions as Lem, short for Lemon Cloak, and Anguy the Archer. Arya and Gendry, still on their guard, go by Squab and the Bull, respectively. From the sigil on Arya's chest, Tom Sevenstreams poses that they escaped from Lord Bolton's kitchens. Hot Pie, of course, goes into more detail about the situation, and he asks the three men what side they're on. We learn that they used to serve King Robert, but Arya thinks they look more like outlaws than King's men. Hot Pie announces they're looking for River Run and asks how many days' ride it is. Tom only says it's a long, hungry way and they should stop for a hot meal at an inn kept by a woman named Sharna along with other friends. He tells Arya to bring the vegetables she stole from Old Pate and has Anguy send an arrow close to Arya's head to show their good faith. Realizing they would stand no chance in a fight, Arya agrees to go with them. Along the way, Hot Pie joins Tom in singing The Bear and the Maiden Fair and surprises Arya with his singing skills. When they arrive at the inn, which is none other than the Inn of the Kneeling Man, Arya immediately sets her sights on the small boat that is docked out front. Sharna greets them gruffly and starts cooking with the help of husband and boy. Lem and husband mention the horses husband sold Brienne that were supposed to be taken back, convincing Arya that they are indeed outlaws. The serving boy then brings them some terrible bread, which Hot Pie isn't too happy about. When husband tells him, "I'd like to see you make better," Hot Pie proceeds to give him a lesson in baking and goes on about pies and tarts, which makes Arya roll her eyes. Then Tom gives Arya a piece of paper saying he's buying her horses for 3 gold dragons. Arya confronts him about being a robber, then tries to negotiate a trade for the boat, which makes everyone start to laugh at her, until they are interrupted by Gendry's cry of "Riders!" Hot Pie and Arya panic at the thought of getting captured again, and in the riffraff that ensues as they try to escape, she breaks Lem's nose with a tankard of ale, but is subdued before getting away. When the ragged band of outlaws enter the inn, Arya is shocked to see among them the familiar face of Harwin, son of Ned's master of horse. Although at first he doesn't recognize her, he ends up realizing who she is and revealing her true identity.
So when you first read this, did anyone remember Aengai, that he almost joined the Starksmen after the tournament?
Nope.
Nope, no. Not until we read.
Yeah.
And he also won the tourney, like the archery competition at the Hand's Tourney in Game of Thrones.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Like, until he's like, "Oh yeah, I won the archery tournament and then lost all my silver, like, with whores and stuff like that."
Yeah.
I was like, "That's the same guy? Oh, okay."
Didn't you do this on an old episode where it was like calculating how many, you know, flagons of wine and whores that you could get for like 1,000 dragons?
I think several times we've been working on
the economics. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it like was how much does 10,000 like stags weigh?
Yeah.
Robert, man, that purse is way too big. Like, I guess you're expecting a noble to win, and they need all that money or something.
I have a question about pronunciation, because you know how this is a sort of like loosely based on medieval England sort of period, and I just wondered, how do you pronounce Aengai? Because is it not Anjou? Like, isn't, you know, in England you have a lot of anglicized weird spellings of essentially French Norman names that came over with the invaders. So
There's a French name that is Tanguy, which is spelled the same but with a T. And so I guess in French it would be Anguy.
Anguy?
Okay. So maybe it's Anguy. Yeah, it just sounds like Aengai is such a non-English.
That really changes it.
Aengai. I think that's how they said it in the show, right?
They said it in the show, did they?
I think it gets said once, doesn't it? Oh, you know, who can remember those heady episodes?
Yeah.
Oh boy, so long ago.
That makes no fucking sense.
That I haven't bothered to rewatch. Yeah. it is interesting though how many of these guys. I mean, the Brotherhood is just all kind of loosely put together, and you know, twist of fate that could have gone a different way for most of them.
So do you guys know of the theory that Lem was Rhaegar's squire? What do y'all think?
Sir Richard Lonmouth.
Yeah, it's his sigil's like a thing of lemons, right?
No, it's skulls and kisses.
It's what?
His sigil is skulls and lips.
That definitely sounds like an 80s metal band, doesn't it?
Next up, opening for White Snake, Skulls and Kisses.
Now, if I actually caught something that I think kind of supports that, and it's that Aengai. No, that's the wrong character. Sorry.
Sorry.
Well, it's It'd be nice. It'd be nice. I mean...
No, I caught that. It was Angai that said, a Dornish girl once cooked me duck with lemons, and I thought it was really weird that Angai said that, because where would he meet a Dornish girl? And he's from the marshes. But yeah, but that's not Lem, so useless.
Probably when he had the 10,000 pieces of silver and he's spending it all over the place. There's got to be like a Dornish whore in King's Landing, right?
Marches are right next to Dorne, so it's not. He could have just easily crossed into Dorne. And...
Okay. Thank you, Nadia, for your encyclopedic knowledge.
We should all be like Greg and just have maps posted everywhere.
Yeah. But going back to Lem, how old would that make him if he was Rhaegar's squire back in the day?
Probably.
Upper 20s, early 30s?
Well, you could be a squire well into your teens, and yeah. Or older even. So, I don't know.
Because it was, 16 years ago, 15 years ago was a rebellion?
14.
Say he was 14. 14 15.
It doesn't seem like he's that old. So, could definitely be possible.
But he tells a story later on where he's like, oh yeah, I lost my wife and children. Who's going to look after them? And it just seems like he has a legit reason to be there rather than being Rhaegar's squire. I don't know. I don't buy it, but...
There's not much evidence, but I reckon we will find out because he'll obviously be with Stoneheart in the next book. And Jaime and Brienne.
Yeah, I just have one question. Was he part of the group that set out from King's Landing that was sent by Ned? Because if so, why would he be in Robert's court if he was... Rhaegar's squire.
Right? It sounds like they kind of picked him up.
Okay.
Well, he could have just been in time, there for the tournament and then kind of tagged. Although, if he was there for the tournament, he wouldn't have tagged along for money, right? I don't know why he would have gone with him. Just for the fun of it?
No, but...
Or maybe he was just on the road?
Later.
Or maybe he...
What he said later was the war in the Riverlands had destroyed his home, so he kind of joined up because what the fuck else is he gonna do?
Everyone in the Riverlands is screwed.
God, it's the worst place to live.
Well, in peacetime, one out of every 6 years when there's peace, it's probably all right.
Like Poland, it's fundamentally a nice place to live, but whenever there's a war, you're gonna get trampled on.
Yeah, I mean, that's why it's not even one of the Seven Kingdoms, right? It's there was no time for a kingdom there. Everyone was too busy conquering it.
Oh, the poor Riverlands. Do you guys reckon that the Riverlands would have made it through this upcoming winter if it hadn't been for the War of the Five Kings?
Probably.
It acted as some kind of Malthusian agent.
The summer is so long, everyone should have been well prepared for winter.
Yeah, but eventually it's the summer's still going? Let's have fun and fucking, not care.
There'll
about
be more
winter.
Time to harvest.
Question, do you know how long they can keep all their stores of grain and everything and salted meat? Because if they start harvesting once spring comes, how long would all of their stores last? Because would they just be eating all of their old stuff and then restoring the new stuff up until winter? Or is it
if they don't have greenhouses,
they keep their
or anything.
Stores from the start and then just keep adding more to their stores?
Well, they probably get stuff imported. That's probably a part of their regular routine is, bringing stuff across the sea as much as possible. But
yeah,
I don't know. I mean, because at Castle Black, they seem to think if we stick it in the ice, it stays good forever, with salted meats and stuff. So I'm I don't know if that's true, but okay.
Well, no, if you deep freeze anything, it can literally keep forever. If you just put something in your freezer, it should be okay for about 6 months or so. But if it's super cold, liquid nitrogen or minus 80, so in our labs,
is it that cold in winter up there?
I don't know, man. It's underneath the wall. The wall's huge. Like, it's got to be fucking real cold. Maybe not like cryo.
So they can't even get to it. They freeze walking in there to get it.
Like, right. I mean, well, doesn't Dance of Dragons, John loses skin when he touches like one of the pieces of meat.
Yes. VOK PSA. Do not freeze your shit where it's going to cause you physical harm to get it out again. That may be seen as overkill. End of PSA.
But it will.
Don't they have gloves? Like
they wear a lot of clothes.
Off his gloves to touch the meat, and then it gets stuck.
Yeah,
rookie mistake.
Yeah, that's on like that's on you, buddy. That's on you. We all know better than to do that.
I was just actually listening to episode 33. And there's some discussion that, you know, Arya has certain psychopathic tendencies because she tends to keep killing people. But then at the end of this chapter, when she sees Harwin and she completely breaks down, you remember that she's just a little girl and she's trying to get back home, and it's really, really sad.
Yeah, she still doesn't want to tell him about killing the stable boy. Like, she still feels, like, super guilty about it.
Yeah, exactly, because he's a connection to her father, and she wouldn't want her father to know.
Exactly. All northern men are, in some sense, a stand-in for her dad, and it's just heartbreaking.
Yeah. I also find it quite amazing how long Arya is, like, convinced that she's intimidating and that she's gonna fight these grown-ass warriors all by herself with their sword, and it takes her really long to realize that they wouldn't stand a chance. Like, she's ready to go at them with that sword.
Oh yeah, she draws. She starts to draw her sword out, and they're like, nope.
She's so silly. Oh,
yeah, and she gets upset when everyone laughs at her, and yeah, I feel kind of sorry for her, but It's also
the simple joys in a chapter like this of, you know, like, people called husband, you know, like,
yeah.
I don't know.
Husband and boy.
Maybe she's had so many. She's just like, husband number three. Husband number five.
You have to play my husband today, so I just call you husband and boy. And over there, you're dead person. I mean, soon to be dead. Oh, I have to come up with a name for that person.
So, do you think husband and wife do the husband and wife duties, or are they just like
separate
bed, like Lucy and Ricardo style?
I think it's more like an improv, and they're just yes anding, you know, and at the end of the day they switch out with someone else. So they don't commit that hard.
So these guys, mate, is this a chapter? We had the Inn of the Kneeling Man. They're the same guys that Jamie and Brienne met up with.
And
that's
they're very obviously talking about them.
Yeah.
Do you want me to do the summary before we start discussing what happens in the chapter? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Adam, do you want to do the intro and the chapters forward and all that shit?
When are the speeches?
Well, that's what I said, but we just did anyway.
When Arya reaches the inn and she sees that picture of a kneeling man, she doesn't realize who it is, which means Arya was really bad at studying. Because I think Sansa...
Oh, that's her, like, great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather?
Yeah. No, it's a very important moment in their history where they gave up their crown so that they wouldn't be killed. And she
doesn't... Sansa would know that.
Yeah, exactly. And, like, Arya probably knows that too, but I feel like she's in such a different context now than when she was at Winterfell taking lessons that she probably wouldn't make the connection. Like, she's alone in the wild now, and I don't think she's thinking about the great kings and lords that she learned about, and it wouldn't cross her mind that she was in the same place. That makes sense.
Well, if it was an image of Nymeria, she'd be like, oh, you know, like, I think it's less important to her, like, oh, this dude giving up, whatever.
Yeah, she doesn't relate to it. I mean, you know, you're talking about this little girl who thinks she can best grown men with her sword. you know, like, this is what is it that resonates with her? It's not the image of a man who's kneeling. So fair enough.
Hmm. Yeah.
Okay. But
at the same time, at the end of Arya 2, she is like a Stark again, because she's been going by like all these different names. What was it, Squab or whatever? Was yeah. The last one she gave. But then, Eerie. Like at the end, yeah, Weasel, like all these things, and at the end, it's like she's back to being Arya when Harwin's like, "Oh, my lady."
Except she done yeah. goofed.
And the tragedy of Arya 3, as I see it, is just as she allows herself to become a Stark again, she realizes ultimately that the Stark man is no longer a Stark man. And that's horrible.
It's really sad.
Yeah, she could have just stayed a peasant girl and, like, they would have just been on foot and on their way to River Run, and it would have been just fine.
Exactly.
Which sucks.
Should I do the summary and then we
can... Yes, let's move on to Arya chapter
3. Can we just say goodbye to Hot Pie before we move on? Because this
Except
is the last chapter that we see him in.
We don't realize we said goodbye until Arya 3. So.
Yeah. Hot Pie, we didn't know that he baked her a wolf-shaped cake. So, you know.
Hot Pie, we hardly knew thee.
All right, Bina, take it away.
Okay, so Arya 3. What happens is we're now 3 days later, and Arya realizes to some frustration that they're still going the wrong way. In other words, they're turning south, and she's quite clever. She realizes this from the side of the trees which have the moss on them. So they're turning away from River Run. And she explains or remembers that Hot Pie has basically done a bunk. So we learn that he's decided to stay as the baker with them at the inn. And she kind of realizes that she misses him more than she thought she would, which is really sad. But actually, she's kind of emotionally making up for that by her relationship with Harwin, a man from the north. And we get a bit of backstory on what happened to the men that her father brought down from Winterfell. So we realize there's only 6 left of the 20 he brought. And we get a bit of backstory on the fact that when Gregor was raiding the Riverlands to draw out the troops from King's Landing, it was basically a carefully orchestrated trap, insert Admiral Ackbar, it's a trap, basically that was designed to lure out Eddard. But the problem is that Tywin didn't realize that Jaime was going to go all sort of batshit crazy and injure Eddard in the leg, which meant that instead he sent out his men from Winterfell, but also Beric Dondarrion with some of his men. So when they finally meet up with Gregor, they get attacked on both sides, and it's just really brutal. But some of them survive. And Beric basically has a 1-foot bit of lance through him, which just sounds so horrifically horrible, that Thoros of Myr pulls out and pours in boiling wine. And the story that Harwin has is basically that Thoros of Myr is some kind of religious man who prayed over him all night. Then that led to a miraculous healing, although we obviously, with the benefit of hindsight, realize that Thoros is raising him from the dead. And then after that, the raiding party, so the Lannister men obviously went off to the Riverlands, and the King's men were left with a dilemma. You know, now they're traitors, so what should they do? And what Beric decided is that they would fight for the people, because everyone else has an army to fight for them. And over time, others have joined up. So that's how they become the Brotherhood Without Banners. So that night in the camp, they are in what appears to be an abandoned village, but they kind of give the secret trumpet shout and out come the people and the food. So they have quite a comfortable night. But then they also learn that Jaime has escaped from River Run, which really shocks Arya. And the next morning they set off again, and she realizes they're still going south and away from River Run, which is really appalling. And she also realizes, because the guys basically tell her, that she is this sort of golden squirrel, which is such a ridiculous thing, but that she's a very high value captive, and they're going to take her to Beric Dondarrion. So this is just absolutely shocking to her. She realizes she truly is a prisoner, but she's on horseback. So she decides, with characteristic Arya pluck, that she's going to make a break for it. So she rides off on horseback, and she kind of makes what she thinks is tactically a good decision, which is to ride into the woods and to try and lose them. But actually, it's a really bad decision, because there aren't any clear pathways. It slows her down. She loses her way. And eventually, Harwin catches up with her. And he gives her the compliment of saying that she rides as well as Lady Lyanna, but reminds her that he was, you know, master of horse at Winterfell, so he really knows what he's doing. And then there's basically this absolutely heartbreaking exchange that ends the chapter, where She's like, well, how can you capture me and take me back to Beric? And he's like, well, I'm no longer your father's man, you know, and your brother Rob, I respect him, and he has an army fighting for him, but the people have no one. So now I'm loyal to Beric and the people. So she agrees to submit for the time being, but it's just crushing, I feel, emotionally, that realization that she was so happy at the start of the chapter to have Harwin, and he's not the man she thought he was. The end.
Yeah, it's terrible.
You didn't say sensual once.
Sensual? Why would I say sensual?
Well, what's that word mean? Oh, man.
Matt's just dragging the tone lower.
It's, I don't know.
That's like, why I'm here.
If she didn't try to escape, I'd be disappointed. But yeah, it's just like she just keeps failing. Because, well, she's still a child, so.
Yeah, she's like, I don't know, 4 feet tall at this point. She's tiny. She's like,
I'm going to draw my sword. Doesn't work. I'm going to run away on a horse. Yeah, it doesn't. Yeah, just. They're just looking at her, shaking her head, like, what is she doing? But, yeah, basically, you should have probably killed Hot Pie somewhere along the road, and this never would have happened.
My impression was this is quite a sort of straightforward chapter insofar as it was just a lot of information dump, bringing us and Arya up to speed with the shenanigans that Tywin was pulling. So you come out of it maybe with more respect for him. But it also kind of, my big takeaway is a lot of what happens in this book and the last book is best laid plans laid to waste by luck. So, you know, Rob has a plan versus Tywin that he thinks Edmure has messed up by doing the wrong thing. And Tywin has a plan to lure out Eddard with Jaime being hot-headed has kind of messed up. So I love the way these books show how contingent war is, that even the best master strategists and tacticians, you know, just happenstance and personal hot-headedness can mess all of that up. So that's kind of cool.
Well, what was it? It's if you're doing well in war, it's probably an ambush or something like that, is it?
If nice you're doing thing. Well at war, you're probably about to bunk off. I think that's what
you're saying. Yeah, that's it.
Well, it just it's so, you know, the best tacticians are the ones that think on their feet. Like, it's probably why Stannis is the best, I suppose.
You know, I want to
Yeah, absolutely.
That,
war requires all these flexibility. Books.
Yeah, and it requires being able to accept failure and find ways around it, right? Like,
yeah, not lose sight of your goal.
In fact, I was listening to a brilliant podcast on this that was about, it was by a military historian who was teaching World War II tactics, and he said the British Army now is trying to teach this thing called, what was it called, sort of intelligent disobedience. That actually military commanders should give very skinny orders, like, you know, orders which are basically, this needs to happen by this date, but to leave it to them as to how they get it done. That actually when you're in the field, even if someone's giving you an order to do one thing, and kind of circumstances have happened, like the classic British military hierarchy, respect things, you don't change, but actually to be able to introduce that element of flexibility, which I think is really cool.
Oh, I have something about the chapter.
Excellent.
So they Harwin mentioned, you know, obviously compares Arya to Lyanna. How far do you think this goes? Do you reckon, like, as in Arya will grow up to be a beautiful lady one day like Lyanna, or, you know, she'll have some of the other traits? I don't know.
Like, well, doesn't Eddard Arya say, like, you have the wolf blood in you, Lyanna had it too, and it got her killed?
Yeah, Lyanna wasn't just, like, you know, an attractive lady. She was, like, you know...
No, because obviously she's the Knight of the Laughing Tree. I mean, but we already know that Arya's pretty badass with a... in a fight. Even, you know, she's, like, 8 years old.
But I guess that brings up an interesting question that I guess we've probably discussed before. But, like, what are our... Like, let's say you take away her father dying and this war and all this. Like, what are Arya's options in life? In like a peaceful Westeros, like what would, like, outside of becoming some random guy's wife, which she doesn't want to do,
she just becomes a lady.
Like, what's I'm saying, yeah, like, what else could she do? Like, could she force her way into something else?
She could always see if Eddard would let her go and stay on Bear Island with the Mormonts. which is an option, and then live with them for a while and get fostered there.
Hmm.
She could squire for Brienne.
The first woman to join the Night's Watch.
Yep.
She could go down to Dorne and kick some ass.
Is it a custom for nobles to foster their daughters away? Because it is for their sons.
I don't know if they foster them, but they do like the handmaiden thing, right? Like a lot, like a lot of the younger daughters seem to go with like higher up royals and whatnot as handmaidens. And what are they learning there? I could like, I don't know. Just make
meeting
connections
men,
and
marry.
How to how to attract men.
How to be real C's.
Pay attention to everything Queen Cersei does.
You want to be just like her one day.
You mean a drunk?
Oh, no. That kind of reminds me of, like, the... I don't know if any of you guys played the Telltale game, the Game of Thrones game they had.
So I have a quote from Tom Seven Strings, and he says, "No harm will come to you. You have my word on that." And he says that to Arya. And I think that's because they still think of Ned as being the Hand of the King. Do you think that's the case? Because later on with Lady Stoneheart, do you think that's why they take her and have her be their leader after Lord Beric gives up his everlasting life and reincarnation type thing?
They do have kind of an odd connection with Ned still, even with him being dead, don't they?
Yeah, it seems really weird that they're all like, "You're a Stark? Cool, I'm down with you."
Yeah, because, I mean, they still refer to Robert, you know, as the king, you know, that's our king. But then when they talk about, oh, he's the Hand's, or she's the Hand's daughter, well, like, they all know he's dead.
Yeah, but, and it seems really
they seem
really
to keep
weird.
That narrative in their head.
Well,
yeah.
Guys, do you reckon, like, maybe they fought with Robert and Ned in the Rebellion? Because they're all of, like, kind of the same age. So maybe their loyalty, like, goes past just, like, you know, the proclamation that Beric Dondarrion, you know, capture the mountain.
But wasn't Beric Dondarrion from Dorne?
Wouldn't have.
Isn't Beric Dornish?
So he no, he was on the Dornish marches. Side.
Dornish.
Oh, okay. But, like, Edric Dane is with them. So, like, the Danes weren't on the same side in Robert's Rebellion, right?
Well, but wouldn't you think, though, if they were, you know, old war buddies or whatever, they'd be talking about, oh, you're Lord Stark's, you know, daughter, or like, instead they refer to him as the Hand or the King.
Yeah.
They aren't using names
the explanation
specifically. It's like the title is more important.
I think since they went away before all the shit show began, they didn't attach themselves to another king, so to them, like, the only king they've known was Robert, and so
in their hearts, he's the true king.
Yeah, and they don't really have a new authority figure to replace Robert and Ned. So I guess they just kept calling Robert the king and Ned the Hand, even though they're both dead.
Yeah, no, I mean, the part where they don't say it's like King Robert or, you know, I don't know. I mean, I get why they do it, but, and it also helps justify their, you know, when they take, here's an IOU, you know, we're king's men. Like, it still helps justify their little narrative of being righteous and all that. So they have to live that reality. I definitely get that. And I mean, who's to say that, at least at this point in the books, that they're not really doing a service more so than most of the people running around the Riverlands?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, we see them, like, stealing from knights, you know, but they're defending, like, the people in the village that are hiding from everyone.
Yeah, like, they wouldn't have just murdered Arya and taken their horses, like, you know, because it's just a commoner, like, that's who they're fighting for, so. But I guess maybe because they were wearing the Bolton sigil, there was a bit more of a, like, hey, what's going on here?
Oh, yeah, maybe.
Yeah. Plus, she came at them with a sword.
Yeah.
She was really scary and intimidating. Guys.
You mean in the
So
head.
Do you think it was, like,
yeah,
a real sword or, like, an elvish knife to a hobbit kind of
No,
a
it's a real sword because she has to tie it to her back because it's too big to wear on her hip.
it's meant to be a long sword, and she finds it heavy and awkward, and it's way too big for her.
It's a rapier?
They said it in the chapter as being a long sword.
Oh, okay.
But not like a, like, I don't know, yeah. Not, I imagine it's Arya sized a little bit, like it's a little bit smaller than normal, right?
Yeah. Because
otherwise she couldn't wield it at all.
I assume it won't be a great sword.
I think you're confusing it with two-handed. A great sword. A great sword is the really big one.
Yeah.
Yeah, but even just a normal long sword for like a 10-year-old, wouldn't that be a little hard, like just the weight and everything? I would assume it'd have to be... somehow you'd have to scale it down.
But she does say it feels big and uncomfortable.
And it's very heavy, it says in that as well.
They should have given her an axe. Anyway, what else do we have to say about this chapter, I think?
I have sort of an Easter eggy bit, which you could have for the... for Lady Stoneheart.
Ooh, go on.
Okay. So, one of the village women is asking Angai a question about whether or not Lord Beric will hang Jaime, and he says, a trial first. Lord Beric always gives them a trial. You know that. He smiled. Then he hangs them. So we know that Lady Stoneheart.
Yeah, which is just so.
Doesn't give trials.
Which is just so much more bullshit, isn't it? I think the Brotherhood Without Banners have this like fictive thing of we pay our bills, we leave script notes, and we give them a fake trial. But how? It's just delusional. They're just as bad as every other marauding band that's out there. Or am I being too harsh?
Yeah, well, because the trial is like already, there's no, it's not like, let's bring witnesses. It's like, you're the mountain, right? You deserve to die, right? Guilty, you know? So.
Yeah, but are the trials that they have in Westeros really that good or that great anyway? Because with Tyrion's trial, you have a lot of fake testimonies anyway.
Yeah, well, I think they do give people the trial by combat. They give people a chance doing that still, right?
Yeah.
There's a Tower of the Hand essay waiting to be written, isn't there, on justice in Westeros or the operation of criminal justice.
I'm sure it's already been written.
Yeah, Valkyra's probably on that shit right now.
Do they wear wigs in court? I'm not sure on that. well, let's move on. Let's move on from this interesting little Arya interlude to the first Sansa chapter in A Storm of Swords. And that is towards the beginning of the book. I think this is the sixth chapter, right?
Yep. It's before John 1. It's a chapter right before.
Yeah, it's right before John's first chapter, and we're getting it at the end here in the linear.
It's a comparatively big jump back, isn't it, for the chapters we're doing today?
Yeah, because I mean, Arya 3 is what, chapter 18, and then we're all the way back here, chapter 6, 7. So,
Bina, had you not taken that work call, we already kind of went over this. Jeez.
Yeah, we discussed it all, but we'll discuss it again. It's okay.
Oh, it's so, okay. I just figured it was more sort of World War II chat when I was away. No worries.
It was like, is Bina going to introduce herself? Or should we just save it for later? We all decided you didn't need introduction, and then you just introduced yourself anyway, so. All right.
Like the obnoxious guest host that I am, just busting into someone else's summary like a dickhead. That's how we
America's
do.
Rubbing off on you, Ben. Dina.
Yeah, you are in Trump's America. So, so I believe, Sarah, you have that for us?
Yes, this one's mine. Okay. Let's take it away, right? Okay, so.
Funk the fuck
when
out
Sansa
of it.
When Sansa receives a dinner invitation from Margaery Tyrell, she accepts. But wonders why Margaery would want to sup with a traitor's daughter. On the night of the dinner, Sansa's hardcore fangirl side gets the better of her when Ser Loras arrives at her door to escort her. She tells him, "You look lovely." Garnering a puzzled look and a, "You're so kind," in return, her heart races and she can only think about how beautiful he is. The pair walks through the training yard in Maegar's Holdfast and see a group of men practicing their sword fighting. Their attention is caught by Ser Garlan, who is channeling Ser Arthur Dayne and is battling three men simultaneously. Loras comments, that Garland is the better fighter. He himself is the better jouster. We shouldn't be surprised at how awful Sansa's conversation skills are when she keeps trying to get Loras to remember the Hand's tourney and the fact that she was the only person he gave a red rose to and told her, no victory is half as beautiful as you. She realizes that Loras is trying to hide the fact he doesn't have a clue what she is on about, but she keeps trying to push him, like all fangirls do, to their pop star crushes, and says it was after he unhorsed Sarobar Royce, only reminding Loras that he killed Sarobar at Storm's End. Sansa, being oblivious to Renly's and Loras's relationship, asks if that's where Renly died. Loras turns frosty, and the rest of their walk passes in almost silence. The Tyrell chambers are guarded by 7-foot twins, Arryk and Eric, or as Lady Olenna likes to say, left and right. Margaery introduces her to the ladies, Lady Allery Tyrell, Mega Tyrell, Alla Tyrell, Eleanor Tyrell, Lady Janna Fosway, Leonette Tyrell, Septa Nysterica, Lady Taina Merriweather, and Lady Olenna Tyrell. Olenna definitely does not support her son's choice to support Renly in the War of the Five Kings, and calls Mace a pufffish and Lord Oaf repeatedly. Olenna lets it drop that she has been gossiping about Sansa to Lord Varys, so she knows that Sansa's love of lemon cakes. When Lady Olenna summons the full Butterbumps to sing the Bear and the Maiden Fair, they start interrogating Sansa. Margaery and Olenna ask Sansa what Joffrey is like. Sansa just responds with, he is fair and handsome and brave like a lion. Olenna asks again, what sort of man is this Joffrey? Finally, Sansa says it, Joffrey is a monster. He lied about the butcher's boy and made my father kill my wolf. When I displease him, he has the King's Guard beat me. He's evil and cruel, my lady, it's so. The queen as well. Olenna responds with, what a pity. Margaery then asks Sansa if she would like to visit Highgarden, and unveils their plan to marry her off to Willis, who she is shocked is a cripple. And their secret conversation ends with the cover of their song.
The bear, the bear.
So yeah. How do you reckon he blew feathers out of his nose?
Magic.
He definitely ate one and had a spare up the sleeve.
But yeah, he just keeps them up there for a rainy day, you know?
Yep.
Impresses people.
I think Butterbumps is one of the great magic users in Westeros, but he just hides it behind this whole gesture thing.
He definitely has one of those napkins that you keep pulling and it just keeps going.
I like how he's like, should I sing it on my while standing on my head?
Yeah.
He's just eager to please that guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is just a great chapter and just like a great scene in general. I'll admit, I didn't read the chapter for this. I just went back and re-listened to the full castle that we had again because that was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
In terms of doing the linear reread, I found it kind of interesting that Jon is being taken to Mance and Arya is being taken to Beric. So both people who are now being taken to sort of, so to say, voices of authority, they're outside of the law. And then also the Arya 3 chapter and the Sansa chapter being put together for me was about disillusionment. So for Arya, who has a romantic notion of Stark men as honourable and, you know, saviours, to be disappointed in Harwyn. And for Sansa, who suddenly realises her pop star fan crush doesn't remember giving her the rose, and this proposal of marriage that ends up being Willis. You know, again, it's for both of the girls. It's about disillusionment. For Sansa, it's bigger because she is the more romantic. But it was kind of interesting to me reading them all very closely together, how that came through.
Yeah. Bina, you might want to order room service so they can block the wind for you.
It's not the wind, it's the pool. It's the trickling of the pool.
Uh-huh.
I'm basically sitting here in my swimsuit, sort of in full sunshine, on a lounger. It's very cool. You should be happy I'm not in the pool doing this podcast.
Did anyone else think it was funny that Sansa was so jealous of the small folk? No, of Margaery, and how the small folk loved Margaery. And she said that Madry had done no more for them than what she had done.
Yeah.
But than what Sansa had done.
Dude, she brought food and stopped them all from being killed in a battle. Army. So.
Yeah, but Sansa didn't do anything bad to them.
The Tyrells were the ones that created the famine in the first place because they closed the Rose Road.
Says it. Or Tyrion. He's like, they cut off the...
But what do the people remember, right? I mean, you're going to blame your rulers in the city of like, hey, why don't I have food? And then when someone comes in bringing food and they make it well known, like, hey, you know, look at I've brought you.
Isn't that the whole thing against Tyrion? Is like, we lived with this evil queen and Varys and Littlefinger before when Robert was king and everything was fine. The only difference is that Tyrion's now like in the mix.
Oh yeah, Tyrion made everything go terrible, right? Like he was all the problems, according to the small folk.
And he was a small folk.
I'll add a sound effect in there for you, Matt.
But
wah wah.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I guess like maybe in Sansa's head, she's like, well, her dad, you know. Like Marjorie's not actually doing any of that. Like that's the Lord that's doing all that, you know. Like yeah. Maybe she's just being kind of a little bitter and like what, 13 about it?
Yeah.
Teenager. I don't know if she's necessarily bitter against Marjorie, more like the small folk. And how it's unfair that they love Marjorie so much and they hated her so much.
Well, and I mean she's a young girl, and I mean she wants people to like her, and she doesn't really understand the way the world works, obviously. I mean, she's learning.
Have you been a young girl?
Well, okay, anyone that age is naive, right? Like, does it, boy or girl, like, you know, she wants them to like her, and she doesn't realize that she never really did much. I mean, what did she show up at like the tournament and like people hardly even know her, and then her dad betrayed the king, as far as they know.
Yeah. I think it's sweet that Sansa in the chapter was also all like, I wish the Hound was here, and why didn't I go off with the Hound? And she slightly regrets it. And then she still has his white cloak in her cedar chest. So, girls, have you guys heard the
Sansan?
Sansan theory. Have you guys heard the theory that that she actually turns that cloak into the one she leaves the King's Landing in after the Purple Wedding, and that she dyes it and makes a hood? Yeah.
No, so she keeps it with her. What's the basis of the theory? Like, where does this is intriguing.
Okay, so the basis of the theory is that with the white cloak, because she'd have access to dyes and everything, and she's done it with one of her dresses before that Arya threw a blood orange at her and got stained, she dyed it a different color. She dyed that one black and wore it I think it was when Ned ended up getting beheaded, she wore it then. So this theory is that she washes it and dyes it, I think it was an olive green, because that matches, or it was a brown, and it matches some of the colors that Sandor wears earlier on, like at the Hand's Tourney, which is the only time he's not going around in like the white cloaks or in his normal gear, and he's wearing like olive green and brown. So she dyes it in those colors to symbolize him. And then because it would be so long, she has enough length to cut off the bottom and make a hood out of that bit. And then she wears it and takes it with her, and that's the only clothing she takes with her, and the clothes she's, and the dress she's wearing.
So the idea would be that she was just making this in hopes of, like, maybe using it to conceal herself at some point?
Or to be romantic, and as well, they have the whole Westerosi tradition of when you marry, you exchange cloaks, the men.
Oh, so you think it's more of a, like, it's like a romantic attachment to Sandor thing?
Yes, because he's been her protector, and then keeping that cloak is a way of keeping him with her and still protecting her.
Hmm.
Yeah, but I think if she had done that, she would think about it when she's like in the chapter where she put on that, when she puts on that cloak, she would like make a mental note that it was, that it used to be the Hound's cloak, because every time she thinks about the Hound, she's like, the Hound who gave me a kiss and a song and whatever.
Yes.
Maybe, yeah. I don't know, maybe George was just trying not to creep us out for once. That doesn't sound right.
I can't remember, but I think there might have been a thing in passing in one of the later books that she still had the cloak with her or something like that. But she only took those clothes with her, and that's up in the veil. She thinks that, and I think that was in passing, but I'm not 100% sure. If I'm wrong, someone tell me.
Yeah, I find it weird that she would pass up an opportunity to think about the Hound.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Think about it overtly, definitely. Because she does it a lot.
Yeah.
Singing that song.
I'm just keep going through these. Okay, anyway. Sansa actually has the moment of thought when she thinks, maybe I am as stupid as Cersei Lannister says in the chapter. And I thought that was really sad. That because of everything she's been to and how it keeps being reinforced by everything, and she keeps being abused by everyone around her, that she's starting to think of herself as being stupid, and it's really affecting how she sees herself.
But I also think that people who criticize Sansa, I mean, I agree with you, it's really sad that, and it shows how bullying and sort of social reinforcement can really affect your own self-perception. But I also think it speaks to a bit of self-awareness, because she has been not stupid, but naive in the past, as you would think of her age. And I love the fact that she's kind of starting to come to terms with that a little bit and take a bit of ownership, because that's how you learn and grow up, right? So it is sad, but I also think it's the start of wisdom. So I would say that because I'm a Sansa apologist, but I love this chapter because to me it's the start of her really, you know, Sansa in Storm of Swords is different from Sansa in Clash of Kings. It's the beginning of the new Sansa.
Well, to play devil's advocate, she is about to make another mistake in telling Dontos about this betrothal.
Yes, her Florian.
So I don't know. I don't know if it's quite begun yet, and she's quite that flawless just yet. I mean, I don't know. I think.
Well, I'm not saying she's flawless. It shows that she's thinking inward, right?
Yeah, and I don't. Yeah. These learning journeys happen in a linear way that you become, you know, 5% more wise every day, and she's at the start of it, and there'll be setbacks, but in a sense, I mean,
because you should look back at yourself like a couple years ago. Sorry, what were you saying?
Carry on. No, you carry on.
I was just saying that, like, you know, when you're especially at that age when you're growing up, you know, and probably, you know, your whole life, but you should look back at yourself, you know, when you're in your early 20s and look back at yourself as a teenager, like, oh man, I didn't know much. You know, I was stupid. And then a couple years later, you look back, no, I still didn't know much. Like, it should be a progression like that. But Sansa's still having a lot of growing up to do. But it is, this chapter is kind of sad. And I feel like they do it a lot in the Storm of Swords, especially, maybe just because it's such a long book. But your hopes get up a lot in this book. Yeah,
especially in this chapter.
Almost this, almost that. Yeah, because this is like, because, you know, Olenna is, you know, she's not a fool. She's got a good plan. She's having, you know, Butterbum. She's, you know, oh, I know people are listening, but she's kind of, you know, having Butterbum sing and like, tell me the truth, and like, she's aware of what's going on, and this probably could have worked out, and you know, alternate reality, like Sansa's in Highgarden right now, maybe not super happy, but. Who knows?
She probably would have been happy, or at least content, though, comparatively speaking, compared to what she's been through. She probably would be rather happy there. And like Marjorie says, there's bards there all the time. She'd love that. She loves listening to all the songs, and she likes the gardens. And
I think she would love the location, right? And the life, but maybe, like, I don't know about the disappointment over not having, you know, the gallant knight as a husband or something. She'd probably get over that. I mean, she's a decent person who, like, you know, if he's a nice guy, I'm sure they would get along well.
And in saying that, Bran's a cripple too now, so she should be more understanding about it anyway, or at least try to be, or was a cripple, but and how she thinks. But she shouldn't just look down on someone for being a cripple because she has someone in her family who is a cripple.
Yeah, and I don't think it's necessarily that she would look down and be, oh, this, you know, this pathetic cripple or anything like that. I just think it's more of the vision that she has in her head as you know, this young girl who wants to marry a certain type of person and have a certain type of life. So, but everything else about Highgarden, I think, is exactly what she's, you know, told herself she's always wanted, all the stories and everything. So, you know, I don't know if the Lannisters would have come for her or how that would have, you know, shaken out if she'd actually gone that way, but it would have at least been better than King's Landing.
Yeah, maybe they would have sent someone to watch over her. Although, I don't know if they would have that power now that she's no longer betrothed to Joffrey.
Well, I mean, Varys is able to get information, so they're not, like, locked in down there, right?
Well, and I think if they had allowed it, like, let's say she just said, hey, we'd like Sansa to just come and have a couple weeks with us. She needs a break. Let's get out of King's Landing. You guys don't need to deal with her for a while. I'm sure they would have sent some guards with her or whatever, but they could have easily just been dispatched and, you know, the marriage happened, you know, and then be like, hey, you got to deal with it now. But I think that even if Cersei doesn't get word of this, if it's just a request from them saying, hey, can she come hang out with us? I think Cersei probably would have thought something like this. Oh, they're going to try to steal her somehow. So yeah, you know, I don't know if she ever would have allowed her in any way. Yeah, exactly. So yeah. They would have had to have snuck her out, maybe gotten approval from someone else. I don't know how they would do that without pissing everyone off.
Well, yeah.
But I guess once the weddings happened.
What would it mean in terms of the war? Because then you've got the Tyrells who have Margaery married to Joffrey and Willis married to a Stark, and they're both at war with each other.
Well,
then you'd kill off Robyn. Right? The Tyrells are pretty great.
Grand Tyrell conspiracy?
Yes, ooh. Grand Tyrell conspiracy. But yeah. No, but I think Olenna's definitely planning for Rob to be killed, because why else would you try to marry Sansa? It's so you can get the North.
So,
and that's why she'd be doing it.
Do you think that she's planning the purple wedding already, or is it when Sansa says how bad Joffrey is that she decides to plan it?
I think it's when Sansa says how bad Joffrey is.
I disagree, because doesn't Littlefinger say, like, he was sent down there, and, like, while he sung Joffrey's praises, he told his men to be like, this is how he treats Sansa, and, like, spread that through
the other people. Yeah, so, and there's a reason she wants to talk to Sansa in the first place.
Yeah,
so I think she's got her ducks in the row of, like, you know, well, this marriage is going to happen either way, but we might have to do something about this king. And so she's probably got all the players, you know, in position. And she just wants to hear from Sansa, like, what's really going on, to make sure that she's not being, you know, fed a lie to do someone else's work for them, right?
But I think their conversation definitely concreted in her mind that Joffrey's gone now.
Yeah, yeah. And even if Sansa hadn't come out and said it, she was clearly so afraid talking about it.
Yeah.
It's like, he's really handsome. His jawline is very
comely. Good.
His perfect hair.
You've said that already, girl. What's wrong with you? The dimples are good. Like, she's like, I don't want to lie, but like, it's like struggling to come up with compliments, you know?
Yep.
Only whereas, you know, beforehand, she would have been able to say all kinds of great stuff about him, right? Before on the way to King's Landing, she probably would have said, you know, the whole book, right? He's amazing. He's kind and generous and loving, and, you know, he's all this stuff.
So now, noble and valiant. Yeah. And
you know, now she's like, well, he still looks pleasant, kind of.
He has the hair of his mom and uncle, but not of his father's.
He looks a lot like a Lannister, I'm just saying.
Oh, yeah, I love how Olenna
mentions that, yeah.
Best thing.
Yes. What spectacular coloring. You know, I think that the rumors of the, you know, the king and the kids being, you know, incest babies, like, is it's just such an interesting thing, because the letters get sent out and it comes up here and there, but you see this like polite conversation. No one's really like, come on, we know what's going on. Like, no one's bold enough to be like, yeah, I'm looking at the king. I get it. Like, and trying to make a move. They're all just kind of swallowing it, which is funny.
Right. Doesn't she say, like, yeah, she says something backhanded, like, the fact that she's the mother is not to be doubted or something like that.
yeah. Well, that's definitely his mother.
Yeah.
What does he get from his father? Oh, I don't know.
Nothing.
Wait, a crown?
He gets a crown from his dad. Yep.
Yeah. titles.
I love Elena.
Yeah, she's great.
She says in the chapter, all these kings would do a deal better if they would put down their swords and listen to their mothers. Realize that is so true.
Yep.
Apart from Cersei. Don't listen to Cersei, but everyone else.
Is there a version of events where, like the War of the Five Kings just ends with her getting everyone around a table and be like, we're going to solve this right now.
Everyone gets
now
married.
Now, Stannis, you apologize, and Renly, you're not the king.
Baelor, are you chewing gum?
you don't even belong here. What are you doing here? I wish we get more of her. So hopefully there'll be more of her whenever, if we ever get another book. I don't know what's going on.
I mean,
didn't he make a joke that it was coming out this year or something? Right, guys. Didn't it'll be different this time, right?
Oh my God, Adam, you have like the battered wife syndrome. It's like, no, he really loves me. He's not gonna hurt me again. I swear, he said it the last time.
I fell on the book. I fell on it. Book? I was reading so late, it just fell on my face.
Do you guys think we will see Elena in Duncan Egg?
Ooh, maybe.
Oh. I'd love to.
Wait, you saw like what's his name, Frey?
Like, baby Walder.
Yeah, maybe
getting it, because she's betrothed to one of Egg's sons.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah,
and he turns out to be gay or something and doesn't
he marry someone else?
There's one that marries for love, right?
Yeah, and then that marries a sister.
Yeah, isn't there a third one? There's one who is the classic, like the company of young squires.
Come on, guys, Gagon.
he's just always at the joust. Yeah, and then you get Summerhall. Whatever happened there?
Sorry, not on Olenna, but did you guys think it was so funny that Garland's actually the better swordman than Loras is, but Cersei doesn't try to have Sir Garland be a member of the Kingsguard? I know he's married, but wouldn't you want him to be the person guarding your back? It's just like,
and she also likes he her could man save you? Young and available, right? So
yeah. And well, it wasn't Cersei's idea though, right? Like, they wanted Loras on the Kingsguard to look after Marjorie.
Right. Yeah.
And also, they knew that Loras wasn't
gonna. Yeah, but wouldn't they want Garland to look after Marjorie? If he's like, the same thing applies, right? Why doesn't Olenna want Garland?
Yeah, he's better.
But it's just because, you know, I don't know. Loras is definitely never going to be the heir. So
right, he's the third.
Or get married.
That's that's just.
Oh,
I think
so
that's more than anything
basically.
What it is.
Well, yeah. Garland's already married. I mean,
yeah,
we don't see an example of like a guy getting offered the white cloak and setting aside his wife.
Right.
Yeah, or like allowing his wife to move in with him and still keep, like, you know, you would think that wouldn't be a bad idea, but
I mean, Loras is,
because we've seen white cloaks that were ruined because of the whole chastity thing, right?
Yeah.
Was it Luckamore the Lusty?
Yeah.
The Dornish prince, Llewellyn, he was, I think Barristan remarks that he sort of kept a few ladies on the side, hush hush.
Yeah, and then,
he had a paramour.
Dragons. Yeah, it seems like maybe if you just kind of let these guys, if you just didn't be like, I don't know. I guess the White Cloak is supposed to be all about, you know, protecting the king, but it's
chastity,
hard to...
purity.
Yeah, it's hard to commit to that, as we see. maybe let them have some fun without, you know, worrying about, you know, whatever. But, because you would never get, like, a primary Stark or Lannister or anyone joining the Kingsguard. I don't know.
Normally, yeah.
Yeah. Like, weird things happen when you're, you know, in love with your sister, so...
Shit happens when you party naked. So Loras is in the same position as Wymar Royce, who was killed by the others because he was sent to Castle Black, right? Like, he basically is expendable. Like, so he has to find, you know, quote, honor wherever he can.
He's a third son.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No hashtag noble problems. It's like, well, I'm the third son, so I can only have like a nice mansion somewhere with like a little bit of land and like kind of live comfortably. Ugh.
Third son problems.
Oh, man.
Unless you become a lord in your own right.
Yeah, which doesn't seem to happen too often, especially since you know Westeros is not an infinite landmass. So you in order to become a lord, you have to find a way to kick someone else out, basically.
Yeah, right. But or you have wars going someone. On, so. Or marry someone like Matt said, yeah.
Marry someone who has no male heirs.
That's right. A Lady like Hornwood. A Lady
how bad do you feel
perhaps?
For the people that married into like the Frey family? And they're like, well, I'm like 15th in line here with my father-in-law. Like maybe no, dude, you're gonna get kicked out when he dies. You're done. Like
I think Joanna Lannister's Jenna Lannister's the only one who's would be fine if when Walder Frey dies because she has her
Riverrun.
Family.
Yeah, I don't know how much longer they're holding Riverrun, but like she seems to have that personality where it's like, no, like I'm gonna get what's mine.
Yeah.
Like she's my husband is just a male mouthpiece for me.
Her whole thing like always reminds me of and you know, Lord of the Rings, the Sackville Bagginses. You know, it's like she's like moving into Riverrun. Like, all right, these ideas, that, yeah. Shows up and is just like, where's the silver at? Where's the, you know, let's get rid of this. I don't like all this fish throwing decor. This is not fitting me.
Yeah.
She's gonna live in like Castle Mildew. Like that place has to be full of disease, right? I mean, come on. How do they not all die?
Wait a minute. Which castle?
Riverrun, just like, you know, sitting in the water all the time and...
Oh.
I don't know.
You know, not the twins that has a tower in the middle of a river?
Yeah, but they're over the river. Like, you know, I don't know. And it's not like... it comes, like, into the castle and, like, you're always going in and out of the water. I don't know. I just think that's a breeding ground for disease, personally.
I think all of Westeros is dirty as shit.
Medieval times are like, antibiotics? What is that?
Yeah. No, but even like, we've been watching shit on like BBC, like Victorian Edwardian, like England. Like, I don't understand how anyone, how we're even fucking here. Like,
we didn't all die off.
It's absolutely vile. Like,
well, I'm sorry to tell you, your wife has a headache. She'll be dead in the morning.
Yeah, exactly. Just watching. I think one of the Chappelle stand-ups, he's like, you know people used to die from diarrhea?
He's like, if you got diarrhea, it was like, oh, I'm sorry, man. You're gone.
Yeah.
Now it's funny. It wasn't funny back then. Like, you died. Dysentery.
You can just picture it walking into a tavern in Westeros. Can I have a clean glass, please?
I'd rather not picture it, though, mate. If you don't mind.
Spit in it, wipe it around with a rag.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, clean now.
What film's that from?
Oh, man. Yeah.
Bring your own mug.
Targaryens seem to be pretty resilient for that stuff. Most of them, anyway.
Well, What, the perks of
the during
of years of incest?
Yeah. I thought that's supposed to ruin your immunity, though.
Yeah. I think it's like magic. You sort of dip below, and then if you keep going, you know, you sort of come around again.
It comes all the way back around, and you reach the next tier.
Yeah. Well, with that you got like, silver hair, and dragons can talk, you know, you can ride dragons.
I was born with all of those diseases. They can't hurt me.
Yeah. You're like a six finger and like mental health disorder, like keeps away a lot of shit.
That's true. It's definitely natural selection. They kind of.
I have like 3 points if you want to. If we want to do,
let's do it.
Then
yeah.
Okay.
Bring us back to sanity.
Okay. With Sansa's crazy creeping on Loras, she notices that the only spot of color on him is the brooch he's wearing, and it's a Tyrell one, and it's a yellow gold flower and jade green leaves. Jog my memory. I don't remember any of the other members of the Kingsguard being able to wear brooches or stuff like that, or are they allowed to? And it's pretty Valen common.
Swan
that
yeah.
Does Jaime wear like the gilded red armor?
Yeah,
You just gotta wear that white cloak.
Yeah, what's his name? At the Tower of Joy had his Batwing helmet, like of House Wendt.
Yeah.
And Sandor had his Hound helm. But yeah. Anyway.
Okay. He never put on a white cloak, so he was like the
next one.
The outcast. Next one, yeah.
I thought it was Sansa thought to herself that about the people who are practicing their sword fighting, that they have scarcely finished burying the dead from the last battle, and they are already practicing for the next one. And I think she looked down on it a bit, but I was just like, man, they need to, otherwise they'll all be dead.
Like, you got to keep those skills up. Yeah.
I thought it was down on them. I think she was. Just sort
naive
of
about it.
No, not even naive.
Like lamenting.
I got the sense that she was like kind of like sad about it, that they already have to prepare for the next battle.
Well, it's an inevitability that she was kind of recognizing.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. I mean, that's her return to reality, where it's not like, you know, the stories where there's like a battle and there's a winner and the loser, and the loser or loser's always the bad one and the winner's always the good one, and then that's like decisive. It's like, nope, this is a kind of like ongoing reality in which she lives.
Yeah. And and it's also bringing like the knights and the squires that she sees training aren't just these handsome young men who are so gallant and who fight in tourneys. Like, they're really fighting a war.
Number 3?
Yes.
Okay, so when Sansa's talking to Loras, she says how sorry she is for Margaery about Renly's death. And she thinks that Dolores is so upset with her because of she's talking about Sir Robar Royce's death and is reminding him of the fact he killed Sir Robar. But why wouldn't Sansa think about Renly and Loras's relationship being that they're brothers-in-law, that Loras was a member of Renly's Rainbow Guard? I thought it was silly.
Are you confused about like her not picking up on their actual other relationship, or?
No, like, she wouldn't really know about their sexual relationship, but she would know about their relationship in being brothers-in-law and him being a member of his Kingsguard. But right. She doesn't even click with that. She just thinks it's about Sir Robar, who Loras killed.
She doesn't have the most. Well, she doesn't have the most accurate POV in this chapter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she is a teenage girl who doesn't have friends.
Yeah, and she's not been getting her copy of Teen Westeros, so she's, you know, probably a little out of it.
Yeah. But she does hear a lot of the gossip, though, just hanging around in the palace, though. So.
From the King's Landing perspective.
Yes.
I mean, even, like, do you even think that she
knows what, like, homosexuality is, or that a man would want to be with another man, or a woman would want to be with another woman. I feel like she's so naive that... Well, I feel like she's so naive that she's just like, she would just think like, well, that's not even a possibility, so she wouldn't even entertain the thought.
Yeah, I think that is the case.
Her entire sex education was like 1 5-minute lecture from Septa Mordane that said, you know, just let your husband do whatever he wants and just bear it, you know.
It's like, when you're married, you have a duty to do things and your husband will explain them to you.
Right, I mean, doesn't even Brand say, like, I've seen dogs mate with other dogs, like, I know how it works.
That's how it's done, right?
Like, yeah. Dog style.
It doesn't even look fun, so, like, whatever, I don't care. Brand.
Sweet summer child.
Literally. All right. Thank you all of you for joining me. This has been great. I'll have to heavily edit this. And join us next time. I think Greg is supposed to be hosting. We're going to go over, the end of October 299. That's Tyrion 2, Dany 4, the prologue, interestingly enough, and Cat 2. So thank you, and follow us on all the different things, mostly the WordPress, Vassals of King's Grave, and on the website, Podcast Device and Fire. And does anyone have any podcasts coming up, anything that's going to be coming out soon? Bina, Matt, I think
nothing from me, I don't think.
Well, because Bina has a poor memory, we recorded one last night, and it should be
coming out. Yeah, but he's talking about podcasts in the future, not podcasts in the
Oh, that's right. It's already been published. She probably published it while we were recording this.
Yeah,
sure. So, I'm trying to get people together to record something about The Expanse once season 2 has finished airing. So if you're interested in that, please let me know. We're going to just talk about the show for now because a lot of people haven't read the books. But
have you read
I encourage everyone to watch this show and read these books because they're awesome.
Yeah, I've just been enjoying the show so far. I've been, I got the first book, but I haven't really gotten into it yet. I'm debating whether or not I should wait, or I don't know. We'll see. But
so, because this reread is more popular than our other psycho serial killer things, we're actually looking for topics that we could talk long form on. We just recorded a thing last night where we each gave about 10 to 15 minutes of recap over a certain person. I don't know if we want to do more of those or like really do some research and get into it. So if anyone has any suggestions, leave them on the forums.
For sure. All right. Thanks, guys.
Bye, y'all.
Bye.
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 Bye, John.
Bye.
Today is gonna be the day when the free folk fight for you. By now we all have somehow realized you're gonna get us through. We don't believe that anybody can stop the wildling horde behind you now. We're told the others bring the cold, cold enough to put our fires out. That said, you've seen The Walking Dead, now you're gonna lead the free folks out. We don't believe that anybody can stop this wildling horde behind you now. From Frostfangs to Bilgewater's icy windings, you've united all the tribes of wildlings. There are many fans and clans who come to follow you, and we're ready now. Mance Raider, you're gonna be the wildling's savior. You're after all, king beyond the wall. Hard feet and never in retreat, there's gonna be a night's watch route. With mans, they'll never have a chance when Jarman's horn sounds out. We don't believe that anybody can stop the wildling horde behind you now. From Frostbanks to Milkwater's icy windings, you've united all the tribes of wildlings. There are many fens and clans who've come to follow you, and we're ready now. Mance Raider, you're gonna be the wildling's savior. You're after all, king beyond the wall. You're gonna be the wildling savior. You're after all, king beyond the wall. Mancerator, you're gonna be the wildling savior. Gonna be the wildling's savior. You're gonna be the wildling's savior. It's
it's Mother's Day over there, huh?
Well, yes, sir.
We all celebrate the Queen Mother, I suppose.
She's everyone's mother.
Uh-oh. Backup recorder is posting in the chat.
How does he do that?
He's become sentient.
So, Noah, have you ever seen the show Escape to the Country?
It's on Netflix.
I've flicked past it, yeah.
Oh my god, I fell down that rabbit hole last night.
And this whole week. rich people buying country homes in England is amazing.
But they're not even that, like, some of them are rich, but like some of them are like, yeah, my budget's like 300,000. I'm like...
Well, 300,000 pounds, budget. And these are like years ago, so that's like, what, half $1 million for like a vacation home?
Yeah.
Either way, I want a fucking thatched cottage in North Yorkshire. I don't understand why.
You wouldn't say that if he'd met anyone from Yorkshire and or realised the weather in Yorkshire is cold and rainy all the time. So Matt, or did someone on the messaging not understand the meaning of the moss?
No, you said done a bunk.
Done a bunk, yeah.
What the fuck does that mean? Did you never bunk off school? Bunking off school means to sneak off and cut class. So do a bunk is just to escape or to leave.
We have bed bunks.
Back me up. That's the same slang.
I didn't realize that was the same slang the British used. Wow.
But see, it's like, what was I watching? They were talking about, like, we were watching Escape to the Country. There was an episode of the guy, they keep saying stuff I don't get. And he said something like, oh, you know, they introduced a new house. Like, oh, yeah, this one really put the cat with the chickens or something. And I'm like, wait, what? I don't.
The cat among the pigeons.
But I'm like, so does that mean that this house was the cat? Or this, like, it's not clear.
No, putting a cat among the pigeons is basically causing a rumpus, causing a disturbance.
Shaking shit up.
Yeah.
Like, how does the house do that?
I was like, is this house eating the other houses, and this is a better house? Like, I was so confused.
This is why we need the culture quiz.
Yeah.
That's true.
That's so weird you guys don't know, like, all those weird sayings. Sorry, Americans. But, like,
so
that's so weird.
We call it playing hooky. Or
we can play hooky,
too, and we can
That sounds
too.
Ridiculous.
Well, I think
we call it wagging here.
Fishing, right? But yeah. Having a bunk, I don't like. I assume that you're going to take a nap.
No, it's not having a bunk; it's doing a
you're
bunk.
You're bunking off school.
Yeah, you bunk a class.
You've bunked it. Oh, you've bunked it now.
No, you don't bunk it, but you bunk a class. You can't bunk it. Oh, dear.
Yeah,
American.
Bunking it sounds like you're, you know, putting your penis into it or something.
Oh, yeah, you're either going to bed with someone or you're taking a nap. I don't know.
You just got sensual.
I bunked my
mind.
Luggage and I threw it in my bed. Like, I don't know. This is
Meanwhile,
very relevant to this chapter.
I was gonna say, is biting chapter analysis, boys.
It'll be cut. It'll all get cut.
Although it's quite a sort of
this
straightforward.
This is
a
good
after show. Yeah.
Oh, Noah, you're thinking of Desperado, where Cheech Marin spits in a glass.
Yeah, was it? Is it a Western film? Maybe I think.
Yeah, Desperado.
Kind of, yeah. It's like modern Western.
It's with my girlfriend Salma Hayek.
What was that movie now? Like 30 years ago or something stupid? Like.
She's still hot and still on my list. And
yeah. But it's just, I start to feel old when they talk about, like, oh, we're going to reboot The Matrix. I'm like, that's not an old movie. Oh, yeah.
They're like, it's 20 years old. Fuck.
There are people that
can, 17.
That can, like, you know, legally vote, and they weren't alive when that was made. So
I was so disturbed that, like, one of the first CDs I ever bought was 10 by Pearl Jam. And when that turned 20 years old about 5 years ago, I was like, God damn it.
You all are so young. I mean, Pearl Jam, that album came out when I was, like, finishing high school.
You were like, oh, Pearl Jam's for young people.
For youngins, yeah, exactly.
Dina, you're aging yourself.
I am aging myself quite literally because I'm sunbathing.
But I get people that are, like, you know, like people at work that are maybe, like, you know, in their 40s, you know, maybe 10 years older than me, and I'll make a reference to something, you know. They're like, wait, how old are you? How do you know about that? I'm like... And, like, it's maybe stuff that, like, you know, like Ghostbusters or something. I'm like, that, you know, it's like, well, that came out, you know, I was born around that time. But, you know, it's like, I know about that stuff. So, but I guess, like, if you're a teenager, if you're, like, early 20s, like, you don't go backwards as much in pop culture anymore like you used to. You don't really, huh?
Yeah, but is that true? Because, like, everyone is still the Punk and the Stones at some point, don't they?
I don't know, though, because I talk to people that don't know about stuff from, like, 5 or 6 years ago, and they're like, oh, well, that's way too old, you know. Yeah, I think that part of it is that we have the internet and social media and streaming services, so there's so much content now. You don't have to go back, and, like, you don't have 5 channels where you just watch the reruns of movies that were, you know, like, I watched old Westerns and, you know, classic Hollywood films, and I can't imagine that very many kids these days do that. Just because they have access to so much other stuff, you know?
Right. It was like you watched whatever was on.
Yeah, and you learn to appreciate it. But, you know, unless someone's forcing you, you're probably, you know.
But, yeah, with social media, like, they keep on having the Facebook anniversaries or, like, friendiversaries and, like, memories.
Oh,
and it's like, it was, like, 10 years ago. And I was
oh, you joined Facebook 10 years ago. No, I didn't. No, I didn't. You shut up, Facebook. You are lying.
Like, look how I was, and people were still alive back then.
I was just using it to, like, spy on people that, like, I was, you know, people were, like, trying to set me up on blind dates, and I was like, well, let me see if I can find this girl, you know? Like, that's about all you used it for then. No one was really on it, but anyway, we're way off the rails now. So, do we want to talk anymore about Sansa?
Is the
I have like three. You go, Nadia.
No, no, I was just asking if you guys are done with the podcast. I just came back after like half an hour.
No, I was like, oh, this must be after show because they're nowhere near them.
We've definitely been after showing. I'm going to give it a proper wrap up here unless anyone has something else they would like to contribute.
Hey guys, I'm back.
Who is that?
It's been a 007.
Why, hello.
Sorry to interrupt, please, as you were.
Don't worry, I'll cut all of this out. Continue now.
You should leave it in, it's pretty funny.
Sorry.
No, it's Skulls and Kisses.
It's what?
His sigil is Skulls and Lips.
Oh,
that definitely kisses. Sounds like an 80s metal band, doesn't it?
Next up, opening for Whitesnake, Skulls and Kisses.